From the Voice of America, welcome to Learning English. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. So, we speak a little slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. On the show today, we listen to an excerpt of another interview from the American Academy of Achievement podcast, What It Takes. We also hear from Learning English reporter Susan Shand about the benefits of a growing bike share culture in East Asia. And Jonathan Evans remembers musician Tom Petty, who died earlier this week. As always, we close the show with an American story. This week, we listen to part 4 of The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. But first, this news from Norway. A group seeking an international ban on nuclear weapons has won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. The Norwegian Nobel Committee is giving the prize to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. The head of the committee, Berit Rice-Anderson, made the announcement on Friday. She said, "We live in a world where the risk of nuclear weapons being used is greater than it has been for a long time." The Nobel Committee said ICAN won for its work to bring attention to the catastrophic humanitarian effects of any use of nuclear weapons. The statement also praised the group for its groundbreaking efforts to achieve a treaty-based prohibition of such weapons. ICAN describes itself as a coalition of non-government groups in more than 100 countries. It began in Australia and was officially launched in Vienna, Austria, in 2007. ICAN's main goal is to support enactment of a United Nations treaty banning nuclear weapons. The treaty was approved in New York on July 7, 2017. The agreement, however, did not include nuclear powers such as Britain, China, France, Russia, and the United States. The Peace Prize announcement comes as U.S. President Donald Trump has threatened Iran and North Korea over their nuclear activities. President Trump told the UN General Assembly last month that he may be forced to totally destroy North Korea because of its nuclear program. U.S. officials now say Trump is likely to decertify the International Nuclear Agreement with Iran. He has called the agreement the worst deal ever negotiated. The president is expected to announce his plans in a speech next week. The officials expect him to say the deal is not in the U.S. national interest. This would not cancel the 2015 agreement, but instead return it to Congress. Lawmakers would then have 60 days to decide whether to reestablish sanctions that were suspended under the agreement. A decertification could possibly lead to talks on renegotiating the deal, although Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has said that is not under consideration.
Americans are remembering rock musician Tom Petty. Petty died on Monday after suffering a cardiac arrest at his home in Malibu, California. He was 66 years old. Petty's family said he was taken to a hospital early Monday, but doctors could not help him. They said he died several hours later, surrounded by family, his bandmates, and friends. Petty and his band finished their most recent tour just last week at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. In December, Petty told Rolling Stone magazine that he thought this would be the group's last performances together. He said, "It's very likely we'll keep playing, but will we take on 50 shows in one tour? I don't think so. I'd be lying if I didn't say I was thinking this might be the last big one." Singer-songwriter Bob Dylan was a friend of Petty's. They performed together over 20 years ago in a group called the Traveling Wilburys. Well, it's all. In a statement to Rolling Stone magazine, Dylan said that Petty's death was shocking, crushing news. The rock star added, "He was a great performer, full of the light, a friend, and I'll never forget him." Petty was born on October 20th, 1950, in Florida. The New York Times newspaper reported that he had a difficult childhood and did not do well in school. Petty said he first wanted to become a rock and roll star after meeting Elvis Presley while Presley was in Florida filming a movie called Follow That Dream. Petty rose to fame in the 1970s with his band Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. They were known for hits such as American Girl, Listen to Her Heart, and You Got Lucky. The group became members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002. But alongside his success, Petty suffered from depression and turned to drugs. A 2015 biography told about his addiction to the drug heroin in the 1990s. Warren Zanes wrote the book, Petty, the Biography. Zanes told the Washington Post that Petty had had encounters with people who did heroin, and he hit a point in his life when he did not know what to do with the pain he was feeling. Petty once told CNN, "Music, as far as I have seen in the world so far, is the only real magic that I know. There is something really honest and clean and pure, and it touches you in your heart." I'm Jonathan Evans.
Millions of people in cities across Asia are using phone apps to borrow bicycles for local travel. This kind of technology is made for people who want to leave cars and motorcycles at home and avoid spending money on a taxi service. The Reuters news agency reports that bicycle sharing has been rising in popularity in places like Beijing, Taipei, and Singapore. China's Ministry of Transport reports that the two-year bike-sharing trend has put over 16 million bikes in China alone. It adds that more than 100 million Chinese have registered for bike sharing. That has reduced car use and demand for gasoline. Economists have predicted that demand for fuel will likely stop rising by the year 2025. I often use bike sharing services because it's very convenient, said 36-year-old Wei Zhang, who uses a shared bike several times a week to go to work. I can find it anywhere and will not worry about losing the bike, the Beijing native added. No one knows the exact number of bicycles on China's streets or how much bike sharing has affected fuel demand. But the government, oil companies, and a study by Reuters all found that fewer people are using cars. Bike sharing has been crazy since last year, said Harry Liu, who works as an advisor for IHS Market. He added that more people are using public transportation because they know they can finish their trip with a shared bicycle. Even before the popularity of bike sharing, observers were saying that the rising use of electric cars and better fuel efficiency meant an end for gasoline's big growth story. China's gasoline demand growth is expected to slow to nearly 4% this year, compared with 6.5% growth last year. That information comes from Sri Paravakarasu, head of East of Suez Oil at Facts Global Energy. Last month, a Chinese bike-sharing startup company opened offices in Kuala Lumpur, Bangkok, and Washington, D.C. The company, called Mobike, was launched in April 2016. Another Chinese company, Ofo, provides a similar service. The two businesses have received more than $2 billion in private investment. Mobike has 7 million bicycles worldwide. Ofo has more than 10 million and plans to increase the number to 20 million in the next 3 months. In Taiwan, the government supports a bike-sharing plan. Officials hope to have 12% of commuters using bicycles in trips to work by 2020. 5% of commuters use bicycles now. The Taipei city government hopes to have every citizen just 10 minutes from a bike by 2018. Harry Liu of IHS said that bike sharing could change the way people think about mobility and could change the transportation business. I'm Susan Shan.
Now we listen to a little part of an interview with one of the most famous names in basketball, Duke University's Mike Krzyzewski, better known as Coach K.
Mike Krzyzewski becomes the first Division I men's coach to win 1,000 games.
No one has achieved more in college basketball than Mike Krzyzewski. No one. As of this podcast, he's won 5 national titles as head coach of Duke University's Blue Devils, a position he's held for over 3 decades. He's also won 3 Olympic gold medals so far with the USA men's national team and 2 FIBA gold medals. That's the International Basketball Association. The list of firsts and mosts in Coach K's bio is a long read. The cornerstone of his success, he said in this 1997 interview,
the relationships I have with my players are the most important thing. It's the most important aspect of my job. I'm selfish about this. I want to know that I've had a positive impact on that young man's life. But I also want him to know that he has an impact on my life. Relationships are not one way. I think coaching is confused at times as being an arrow that only goes to a player. Those players send arrows back to you, and that's where a relationship is developed. I don't make a player. When they go on that court, they're, even though I'm coaching them, they're alone out there. They're in their underwear. I mean, they wear shorts, and they're exposed. They have to know that they can do it. Now, am I there for them? Yeah. But they have to know that they do it, and I tell them, I say, I'm impressed with how you can do that. The other thing that I think it's really important for kids to understand is that, like, when I come into a locker room before a game, people might anticipate, you know, if they don't know sport that well, that, oh, yeah, we're going to win one for this, and we're going to do it for Duke, and we're going to... That's not always the case. Sometimes I go into that locker room, and I'm afraid. And then all of a sudden I look at Bobby Hurley, or I look at Steve Wojciechowski, or Grant Hill, or kids who've played for me, and I see in their eyes anticipation. I see ambition. I see a glaze. And all of a sudden I say, holy mackerel, I got a chance to coach these guys tonight.
To hear more from the famed Coach K of Duke University, go to the What It Takes podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Next up, an American story.
The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. Part 4.
Murder had come to the old house on the street called Rue Morgue. Murder had come and gone and left behind the bodies of an old woman and her daughter. It was a perplexing crime scene. The damage to the daughter's body suggested a killer of superhuman strength. The knife that had killed the old woman, almost separating head from body, was in the room. But the old woman's body was outside, behind the house. The door and windows to the house, all firmly closed, locked on the inside. Voices had been heard. One voice was speaking in French. The other voice had not spoken even one word that anyone could understand. And yet, there was no one in the room when police arrived moments after the attack. My friend Dupin was now explaining to me what he had learned when we visited the scene of the crime.
I knew that what seemed impossible must be proved possible. The killer, and I believe there was just one, escaped through one of these windows. After the murderer had left, he could have closed the window from the outside, but he could not have fastened the nail. Yet anyone could see the nails which held the windows tightly closed. This was the fact that stopped the police. How could the murderer put the nail back in its place?
That's the problem, Dupin. Perhaps if you pulled out the nail?
Yes, that is just what I thought. Two things seemed clear. First, there had to be something wrong with the idea that the nails were holding the windows closed. Second, if it was not the nails which were holding the windows closed, then something else was holding them closed, something hard to see, something hidden. so I checked the first window again. I removed the nail. Then I again tried to raise the window. It was still firmly closed. There had to be a hidden lock, I thought, inside the window. I searched the window frame. Indeed, I found a button which, when I pressed it, opened an inner lock. I raised the window with ease. Now I knew that the killer could close the window from outside and the window would lock itself. But there was still the nail. So I returned the nail, pressed the button, and again tried to raise the window. The nail held the window closed.
Then the window could not have been the means of escape.
That window, no. The killer did not escape through it. But I went again to the other window. The nail there looked the same as the one I had just seen. I moved the bed so that I could look closely. Yes, there was a button here too. I was so sure I was right that without touching the nail, I pressed the button and tried to raise the window. And guess what happened?
I knew the answer, but I let Dupin have the satisfaction of reporting. The window went up, he told me.
As the window went up, it carried with it the top part of the nail, the head. When I closed the window, the head of the nail was again in its place. It looked just as it had looked before. The nail was broken, but looked whole. And what is impossible is proved otherwise.
So the murderer went out that window. Did he arrive in the room by that path as well? Dupin answered, although it seemed he was speaking more to himself than to me.
It was a hot summer night. Would the victim have opened the window to get some fresh night air? Most likely.
So the killer found it open and entered, I said. Dupin nodded.
And as he came in, the window locked when it closed. The lock held the window closed, not the nail, as it appeared to investigators. Again, that which seemed impossible was actually possible.
Dupin's eyes were shining with the satisfaction discovery brings. He was analyzing evidence, and his unusual reasoning ability had found a great purpose. I suddenly understood. This is why going to the house on the Rue Morgue seemed pleasing to Dupin. The use of his sharp mental abilities made him happy. And I had more work to provide that great brain. Dupin, the windows are on the fourth floor, far above the ground. Even an open window. Dupin shook his head up and down slowly.
Yes, yes. That is an interesting question. How did the murderer go from the window down to the ground and vice versa? But I had looked around carefully outside, you recall. And I knew a way. And the answer to this question told me still more about the identity of the killer. Do you remember, friend, the lightning rod attached to the house?
Yes. A metal pole, and quite narrow. It protects the building from lightning strikes. But it is so tall and thin.
True. It would take great strength and agility to get up the pole. Some kinds of animals might climb it easily, yes? But surely not every man could. In fact, maybe very few men. Those of very special strength and special training. This helped create a better picture of the murderer, but still not sharp enough to recognize. I still had the question, who? We know the killer climbed the pole, entered the room through the window, murdered and destroyed all order in the room. He managed to push one body up the chimney. He threw the other, almost headless, out the window. Then he left the way he came. We can answer the how of the crime, but who? Such unspeakable viciousness. What human could do this to another?
Dupin continued, trance-like again, seeming to speak to himself as much as to me.
Perhaps we can come closer to answering the question of who by exploring the question of why.
But Dupin, the police said the motive must have been robbery.
But, my friend, what was taken? The police said they could not answer the question. They said they did not know what the women had. Maybe clothes and jewelry, the investigators proposed. But neighbors described the women as nearly hermits, rarely, if ever, leaving the house. Of what use would fine clothes and costly jewelry be to them?
Dupin's eyes were glistening, his brows pointing sharply down, as he circled me, thinking aloud.
But what is more telling than what the killer might have taken is what he left behind, conveniently in bags in the center of the room.
Of course, the money. You are right, Dupin. It makes no sense. All the money delivered from the bank to the old woman, right there on the floor? Why would the attacker have passed on the riches? A thief certainly would not.
So I want you to forget the investigators' claim that the killer acted out of a desire for money. They thought this only because they knew the money had arrived just 3 days before the killings. But that was just chance. If gold was the reason for the murders, the killer must have been quite a fool to forget and leave it there. No, I think that there was no reason for these killings except, perhaps, fear. The wild nature of the attack leads me to a motive of fear.
An interesting theory, Dupin. Fear can bring out the crazed beast in a person.
In any living thing. Now let us look at the murders themselves. A girl is killed by powerful hands around her neck. Then the body is placed in the opening over the fireplace, head down. Unusual, even by the standards of the most terrible criminals. Think also of the great strength needed to put the body where it was found. It took several men to pull it out. Also, the hair pulled from the head of the old woman. You saw it on the floor yourself, and you saw the blood and skin still attached. It takes great force to pull out even 20 or 30 hairs at a time. But this was hair and scalp. And there was no reason to almost take off the woman's head just to kill her.
It is extremely odd, I agree, especially since there is no evidence that the killer knew the victims. No one could hate a stranger enough to carry out such torture. Dupin's eyes narrowed.
Exactly.
That's all the time we have for today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you return too. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.